Picture that's up here right now is a dog that I just saw this past week, and I'm going to talk about that one in a minute. But just to recap a little bit about what we spoke about, that fear-based behaviors generally have a lot more to do with space than anything else. So when approaching Flocka, well, it's better if she approaches you. So any fearful animal should approach the person should not approach the fearful animal. This includes people who say, all dogs like me, which I'm sure some of us have heard before. And it's very difficult when you own a fearful dog to try to come up with some kind of a phrase that says, well, your other dogs might like you, but my way of liking you is to bite you, you know. And so one of the things that we do is we end up coaching people about how to speak to other people about what they should do with your dog, which is really funny when you think of it. I mean, we have children running around, and I don't think most people, well, maybe they do. Do people run up to children and or to pick them up and stuff like that, even though the kids?
Sometimes.
Yeah. Sometimes they do that. So I think that adults, a lot of adults feel like we're very privileged, and we get to be the ones who decide what we're going to do, and these guys can do the same thing. They can decide. So the other thing that's about space that's really hard for human beings is that when we like someone or we like a dog, we think we like the dog, then we forget about their needs. And I think most communication regarding, I thought you were talking to me. She's going like this. So what we do is we think that our desires, our emotions are the most important one. And in reality, in the case of a dog, it is their emotion that is the most important one because they're the ones who are fearful. And you actually have to sublimate your own ego. And I think that's very difficult for people. So yesterday, I was at a consult with an extremely fearful healer, and this dog is like between 6 and 7, and she is, I don't have a picture of her, but she is, the owner is a really, really nice person, a very what I would call giving, soft, nurturing kind of person. This dog, when she wants to get up in the morning, she pulls her covers down. and she tells her when she wants to play ball. So if she's playing ball, she brings the ball back, drops the ball, and immediately starts barking to get her to throw the ball again. And essentially, this woman kind of lives for her dog. The horrible thing is she went to a variety of different trainers, both in Massachusetts and here, and was told in no uncertain terms over and over and over again how much of a failure she was. It really sounds awful. And in fact, one of the things that this dog is highly territorial. It took me, well, she never liked me. Sublimate your ego, you know. She never liked me. It's okay. She cannot. So what happened was I got into the house, and we just did the normal thing for getting into the house with a fearful dog and had her in a room and then brought her back out again. And I was sitting at a table, and she loves carrots, absolutely adores carrots, which is nice. So she cut up some carrots for me. And the dog came in, did a couple little snips, but nothing, it didn't touch anything. She has bitten one person. And then she kind of started to bark at me and then go back and forth and bark, and I was very still and all that kind of stuff, but she was taking space and giving it up and taking it and giving it up. And then I started throwing treats so that she could, I mean, just throwing pieces of carrots so she could go get the carrots and whatnot. But I don't think she ever, ever got used to the idea that I was there. So one of the trainers that she had spoken to, somebody in San Francisco, told her that she needed to have more people come over to her house. Well, she'd recently moved from Massachusetts. She doesn't have a lot of friends here. And she's a fairly probably introverted person as well. And she said, I just don't have very many guests. And this trainer said, well, you have to have more guests. And she said, but I don't know anybody. And I, you know, how am I supposed to have more guests? And this trainer, who is, okay, an idiot, I mean, an idiot. She said, put an ad in Craigslist. And offer to pay people $5 to come in and meet your dog. Really, honestly, she lived in Petrillo Hill. This is not the best place to be offering $5 to have somebody come in and visit a single woman, you know, with a fearful dog who might bite you, you know. So to me, this was like just absolutely out of this world crazy. It does let you know how many crazy people there. Because this woman, I've gone to her website, and she, I'm not going to say it on tape, but anyway, she's got all these testimonials of how wonderful she is and all that kind of stuff. So, but you know, this dog had these space issues, and we never really did get to the space issues. And one of the things that I recommended, the relationship is all wrong, right? The dog is running everything, and the woman just loves this. So, what I did is we talked about kind of shifting some ways to shift the relationship a little bit more towards her, and a little bit back the other way towards you know, so that the dog isn't taking over. And I gave her one exercise to do, and I was thinking about this last night, why I decided to do this one exercise and one exercise only. And I think it's to make her feel good. I think it's to make her feel like that the shifting of the relationship is only part of this. And the one exercise that she's doing is going to be really, and it will be really important. It's not that it's not really important. It's just that the relationship shifting will be far, far more important. And whether this dog will be safe again, I don't know. For 8 years she's been doing this, so she may not. The exercise, by the way, was sit stay. That was it. Just sit stay. Sit stay in one room, then another room, then another room, then another room, then outside, then in the road, then in the car. Just sit stay everywhere so that she feels like she's really taking control of the dog. So this is another dog that I just saw who also has space issues. His name is Jim. Jim, here he is here. I think it's a great name for a dog. And Jim is terribly, I'll tell you his story in just a second. Really, really fearful.
He'll be better with you.
So look how scared he is. He's a really a good
this could be a terrible guy.
Example of a terribly fearful dog.
Yeah.
We shot him together. I was there.
Let's check him out.
Yeah. And then he stretches
and
forward
I was talking
to make sure that it's not going to kill him when he gets it. And then he can run away.
That's as close as he got to me.
Checking you out.
Yep. This is in his own home.
This is just cheese. So it has, it's kind of, they can smell it, and it's very attractive.
Well, I've learned, I'm from Vermont.
He looks feral.
I keep
has kind of
seriously sharp cheddar on the end, and
he really likes it.
He really likes it.
How long have you been here?
This dog, his name is Jim, as I said,
4 years.
Lucked out.
Do you like it here?
Love it.
Man, did he luck out.
Vermont's kind of cool.
Oh, that's incredible.
He was a dog that came
also
from,
very cold and gray for
it was found with a female dog and four puppies in
the area
around
Modesto.
Yeah,
actually, I lived in San Francisco.
Taken to Modesto's shelter, taken from there to the Milo Foundation.
Mm-hmm. This area reminds me a lot.
And the female, those were up for adoption when Oliver found him. And he took him home and realized that he had this feral animal.
So this is
in order to take him to go to the bathroom.
That maybe I'm not going to actually come out and kill him.
He has to pick him up and carry him out. And this guy's about 55 pounds, 55 pounds. He won't go anywhere. It's been very difficult getting any kind of equipment on him because he's so terrified. And so one of the things we were talking about is what kind of equipment to put on the dog. And he asked a flaca, really? Your dog just piddled. Yeah. you can use toilet paper.
They have stuff in open spray.
Oh, okay. You just have to get back to it.
I just have to get over there.
Yeah.
Sorry. It happens when you get here.
There she is, right there. Okay. Yeah. So anyway, the biggest thing about the reason the dog lucked out is because the guy said he was in a hurry in the very beginning. He thought take the dog home, give the dog some love. Dog's gonna be okay. And he said he's had the dog just 2 weeks. He says, this dog is not going to be fixed like this. This is going to take a long, long time. And I'm like, yes, this is going to take a long, long time. And he says, well, I'm in it for the long haul.
Aww.
So he absolutely, the dog is totally lucked out. And the guy can pick him. He lives in an upstairs condo. So he can pick him up and take him downstairs. And then it's outside right away. But the dog is just afraid of pretty much everything. It really is sad, and he really is lucky. And this dog was interesting because, unlike the healer and unlike Flaca, for that matter, he showed no tendency towards aggression at all, ever, from the time that they got him in Modesto to the time that he was in this place. So he's really, really good that way.
Did the Milo Association tell him anything about the dog? Or
they probably.
Okay.
No, when he went to adopt the dog, he said he wanted to sleep on it overnight because he liked him, but he wanted to sleep on it. And they said, we'd really prefer you didn't because we're getting 35 dogs in tomorrow. So, no, they probably didn't know very much about him. They probably didn't really walk him. They're a rescue foundation in the most strict sense of the word. They're not geared at ascertaining what the dogs are like and then making sure they place them with good families. I just read an article, or just started to read an article, in I think it was the New York Times about why is it so hard to adopt dogs. Anybody else read that? Yeah. And because, if there are so many millions of dogs that need adopting, why is it so difficult to adopt them? And I have not read the article, but I'm mad at it already. Because when you work in a shelter or you work for a rescue, it should be hard. It should be something that you think about, that you don't just pick up the dog and take it home and put it on as though it's a coat or something like that. It should be difficult. It should be something that they really have to think about. And Kathleen, what did they say in the article? Because I didn't read the same.
I'm mixing up a couple because I read a few at the same time.
Yeah. It's a numbers thing.
Largely numbers and what else did it say? Something about.
That's okay. I don't want to put you on the spot.
Yeah.
But yeah, but there are a lot of people who say that. Who say, well, in fact, Nathan Winograd, who is the jerk who runs.
The gentleman.
The gentleman who, yeah.
I did not.
Well, anyway, Nathan Winograd says, well, if every home adopted, like a dog and a cat or whatever, we wouldn't have any excess animals. Well, every home is not capable of handling, animals, and nor do they want to, nor is there any reason why they should. It is actually an expectation that is not realistic, that then is broadcast, and people believe there's no reason to have any overages, have a surplus of animals in the shelter world. And of course it makes them sound really good, and it makes everybody in the shelter world seem like they're meanies, and they're not. Anyway, so back to Jim. I think that because he's got such a great owner, I'm sure he'll make great strides. However, he's about 12 to 15 months old, they don't know. And so it's going to take him a long time, and he may not get, as acclimated or so socialized as he would like him to, but he's willing to accept that. So, and he wants to take him to work, so we've figured out a way for him to take him to work on the days that nobody else is there, so the dog starts to get used to that, and then to kind of slowly, gradually get him used to having other people there and whatnot. And we're gonna crate train him. Don't worry about it, Aspen. It's nothing. It's actually, I think it's gonna be really good. So, touch. Good. And don't worry about that. Yeah, I know. So, when writing this thing, I was thinking, you know, fear aggression, we lots of people know and talk about fear aggression, and really what it should be called is defensive aggression, right? It should be called defensive aggression because it is defensive. In fact, I really think that there's not enough words for the word aggression. They're not, you know, aggression is an all-encompassing word that does not mean what a lot of it is. So this is basically defensive behaviors, which involve increasing the amount of space between the dog and a person, or a dog and another dog, or, you know, even a dog and an item, because that's what they're going to do, is they're going to move back. So that dog, whoever that dog is, believes that he or she must be proactive in order to be, believes that he has to be proactive, then he is going to take that action. But the biggest thing that happens with fear aggressive dogs is that they do not continue, right? They'll do what they do, like they snap, and then they stop because what they want to do is increase space. They're not trying to hurt anybody. And another dog I saw this week, the people said that the dog has nipped two people. She must have said that about 8 times. I said, did this draw blood? Yes. But it was a nip, and as opposed to a bite, even though the dog, there was a quarantine and all that kind of stuff, but it was still a nip. And it was very important to her, and I actually understand why it's important to her to have this be a nip instead of a bite. This was a German Shepherd who scared the bejesus out of me. She was about that big. I mean, I was sitting, my chair was too low. I mean, I really want to go a little higher because her head would just come right up to here. And she'd come over and kind of go, I'm like, okay, fine, I'm really good. You know, this is keeping me young. And But the reason they wanted to call it a nip is because it was a defensive maneuver. And it really was. So somebody was trying to actually, in this case, somebody was trying to shake the husband's hand. And the dog is protective of the husband. It was a complete reverse of a lot of the dogs that I see. The wife was very strong-willed and very traditional in her outlook on training. The husband has never had a dog before, very, very soft, very nice person, and just lets the dog get away with murder. And so the dog has now decided to take care of the husband, to the extent that if anybody approaches the husband, she will nip him or her. So they're now starting to take, he's now starting to take it seriously and to understand that, you know, he's got to control the relationship or else the dog is going to do it. And this dog is afraid of everybody, so she's going to try to get everybody to go away from him. And I think that it's a little late, but I think it'll start to work. So they did tell me that this would be taken care of, and then I guess a couple volunteers didn't show. So this is why we've got the barking thing going on. Yeah, and we could stop the whole thing, go evaluate it right now. Yeah. Okay. So if most of the time, if whatever the dog is afraid of doesn't move towards them, the issue is resolved by not typing anything here. It just says, the issue is, but the issue is resolved because the dog doesn't feel like it has to do something, which is of course why when you've got a fearful dog, that dog, and you sit down and you don't move, the dog kind of starts to calm down and everything is okay. But as soon as you begin to move, that sets the dog's amygdala going again. And then as John Rogerson says, fearful dogs have that. Well, actually, what he says is that border collies have the shortest attention span of any dog because everything is brand new all the time, right? And you can say that that's true of fearful dogs, right? Everything is brand new. Every second is a new, they're living in a scary movie. And so everything is a startle reflex, just kicks it in. So with the healer, if I do this, so I didn't need to go to the bathroom, I didn't need to do anything, I just was going to sit there and kind of take it, you know, just very, very, be very calm about the whole thing. So this is a dog that's overprotective of the baby. You saw a picture of her last time. This is some video of her. So she, this girl, her, she's also very fearful. Right now I can't remember her. Oh, she was also found in the valley. She also had puppies. The puppies were adopted out, but she was not adopted out. And then this woman got her, or this couple got her. The dog is very attached to the people and extremely attached to the baby, to the extent that if the nanny comes, she growls at the nanny. So she also growled at me, and you can watch her, this, and she has such eyes. Such eyes.
This is her. Touching her.
I see. Hi, Flo.
Hey, Flo.
I know.
Can you hear the cat? So when the woman was holding the baby, she put herself right in front of the baby, and she wouldn't move if, you know, if I shifted around. Other than that, she was not nearly as dangerous as the healer because she didn't want to do anything, but she definitely was growling to make people go back. Can you believe those eyes?
Yeah.
Yeah. So they are so spooky looking that she makes people get afraid of her. And if people are afraid of her, I bet that just keeps it rolling, you know.
Is this the one that you said the wife liked her being protected?
No, that was a boy dog.
Yeah. And that was the woman had some kind of neuroses. In this case, they know very well that there is an issue here, and they really want to address it. The first issue is how to get it so that the dog allows the nanny to come in and take care of the baby, because that's a really important consideration. I was thinking the other day, how many houses there are, how many families there are that have housekeepers and nannies.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just amazing. That is, it's actually, it's a sea change in our culture, I think.
Everything's outsourced.
Yeah. Okay. So fearful dogs, as we've talked about, target their fear to either like all strangers or men. Sometimes men that are tall, sometimes men that are loud, some that have hats on, some women that have hats on, people who have very large profiles, people are tall and skinny. They just seem to pick what they are afraid of, and they're going to be afraid of it. Many dogs that are fearful are afraid of children. And they are also more courageous with children, which makes it worse, right? Because children are less... they're less intimidating, but they move a lot. And when they move, it's very difficult to see, you know, to predict what they're going to do. So they become afraid of that. But they're also more likely to actually take action to move the child away. You know, I can't remember the statistics now, but out of 3 to 4 million bites a year, the vast majority are to children and old people. Because they are... probably because of the same thing. They probably both move rather unpredictably.
Do you see the difference in the
age? I beg your pardon?
Do you see the difference in the age of the children? So I had a dog who, if they were under, I'm going to say 6, she would hide. But if they were older?
There were no problems?
There were no problems.
Yeah, actually, I believe, now this may not be right, but I believe the last thing I remember was that the most commonly bitten people are 12-year-old boys. Yeah. I mean, their behavior is going to play into that a lot. I think it's going to cause that. But it's certainly that kind of preteen boy, as soon as they become teenagers, they're like, you know, they're not, they don't care about the dogs anymore. They're hormonal, so they just go want to go to the opposite sex. So other dogs can be fearful of other dogs and often will pick one type of dog to be afraid of. And I think an awful lot of owners know this now, because when you talk to them about the dog's fear-based behavior, they say they don't seem to like black dogs, or they don't seem to like dogs that German Shepherds or Huskies or something like that. The problem is that fear generalizes. It does not say the same. So say you have a dog that's afraid of guys, okay? Which is, again, a fairly common kind of fear for them to have. If you don't address it, if you just kind of try to avoid guys, which is pretty hard to do, there's 50% of the population, you know. But anyway, if you just try to avoid guys, then what'll happen is the dog will start to expand her fear. And it can then actually encompass maybe taller women or maybe whatever. So they just get bigger and bigger and bigger. And the same thing is true with dogs. So if your dog is attacked by a German Shepherd and then becomes afraid of German Shepherds, if it's not addressed, then they will then become a fearful of all big dogs, and then, you know, or all dogs with prick ears or whatever. And it just kind of snowballs. And I have seen, I know Tricia has too, dogs that do not like big dogs, but are fine with small dogs. And in fact, Luke is like that. Our dog Luke, he is very wary of large dogs, but small dogs he's never had any kind of issue with at all. So he's great with them. And so that stopped right there, but he does not like big dogs, and I still don't think there was any trauma. I just think it was some kind of change in his... Something happened to him, but we don't know what it is. Okay, so the general types of anxiety in their manifestations. Separation anxiety is the inability to be left alone without going into high levels of distress. The German Shepherd that's in there may very well have separation anxiety, because she calms down really quickly when Megan goes in to see her. And then as soon as she's left alone, that's when all this barking stuff happens. So she may very well have that. Generalized anxiety would be hypervigilance and nervous behavior much of the time or most of the time. And dogs that just really have trouble a lot of times with their digestion, they can't settle down. It's really difficult to be them. I mean, it really does seem to be difficult to be them. And then OCD behaviors, which we talked about in the anxiety module two. Repetitive behaviors often occurring with no known trigger. And by the way, the people that I'm apparently going to be seeing, this woman who's got the dog with the tail, you know, the OCD thing. Although I don't know why, because she says, well, it's way better, but I still want you to look at the dog. And I'm like, why would I want to see the dog? I don't want to see a normal dog. What are you? I want to see abnormal dog. Yeah. So fear of noises is really common, and the dog that I was talking about, Fred, no, not Fred, what is his name? Jim. Jim, Fred, John, Peter. Jim, he is extremely noise sensitive. So any kind of noise, and he gets very upset. And what's good is they live in San Anselmo, right next to a pretty busy road. So there's a lot of traffic noise all the time, which is a good place to live for a fearful dog, because then it has to be a much bigger noise in order to cause him to get to have his response. But he's definitely fearful, and pings and whistles are the worst. So the guy can't use his microwave, or he has to catch it before it ends. Anybody else? Anybody here got a dog that doesn't like that kind of stuff?
Yeah, one of your dogs. As soon as you turn on your computer, she runs.
As soon as I cough, she runs. Yeah. She can cough all she wants. No problem. I cough and Flock is gone. You know, like, oh my. It's ridiculous. So anybody, nobody has that? Well, that's really good. Yeah? What's that? Smoke alarms, I think 90% of dogs on smoke alarms.
I have boys with that. He's better with it, but I don't want to. know when you plug speakers into a computer?
Oh,
so if you have the speakers on it.
Yeah. It goes pop.
Yeah. And he would not come into the classroom for like days if he ever thought that was going to happen. As he got older, he's still sensitive to it, but he...
If he's been able to handle it a little bit more.
It,
yeah.
But it was such a benign noise.
Yeah, and children does that. When a microwave beeps, she'll do her little circle thing, run off, but then come back down. It's like,
so okay. Her resiliency is good.
Yeah.
But she, it's a noise still startles her, but then she's a resilient.
Yeah, I'm a little emotional. She has some, I think, a little bit of anxiety. She, the vent on the stove, if you even have it on low, all of a sudden, we didn't realize it for a long time. The tail's between her legs, and she has to get outside. She just is.
This is the vent over the stove?
This is when you turn it on, like if it's too smoky or something. So now we don't ever turn it, we just open it.
So you just have a fire.
Yeah, we just open it. Yeah. No, it's just generally like, yeah, we didn't realize it. All of a sudden, I'm like, why is she so. It didn't even dawn on me that it would be the vent on it. But it is. We turn it off. 10 minutes later, she's fine.
Yeah.
It takes her a few minutes to like.
So Chicklet at this point has high resiliency, comes back very quickly.
Yeah.
And Mochi, not so much.
Not
10
fast.
Minutes is a little bit longer.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. Or if you pop the top off of the plastic bin, she runs. And if you if something drops, even if it's not heavy, she'll jump and move her place where she's been sitting. And if she's outside, if someone's washing their car, the sound of the water, or God forbid, any type of lawn maintenance type of thing,
yeah.
She's like,
she's gone.
She doesn't like that at all. She usually strolls very slowly, but. And she hears that voice, she puts on the speed.
Okay, so you can see these are all fear things because the dog is trying to increase the amount of space between them and where they think the noise might come from, which I'm going to talk about in a second, too. So, yeah?
We have a funny one. Little Tucker. You know, the dogs each have their feeding places. And in the very beginning, Tucker was fed in the kitchen and the other dogs elsewhere. That was a big mistake, but we didn't know that. Time it takes a long time to figure it out. Well, if he's being fed, no one is allowed in the kitchen. If you come, you can stand there very quietly, but if you should say anything or touch anything or make any kind of a sound, he leaves his food and comes and stares at you until you leave the kitchen and he'll go back.
They go back and start eating again. So that's a really interesting behavior. Actually, Flocka has it to a certain extent as well. The, you know, she wants to be like kind of left alone when she's eating. And if you think about it logically, I think that probably it the act of eating makes them vulnerable. As soon as their head goes down into a bowl, they can't, and they're chewing. And you know, when you chew, you can't hear, you're hearing chewing. You know, you're not hearing outside noises. So a fearful dog then would have a tendency to eat only when it thought that there was not going to be any danger around. Because it's, and if you think of the way deer eat, they take a piece of grass, and get up, chew on it, look around, go get some more grass, look up, chew on it, look around again. So that is the way prey eat, and that's the way Tucker eats, probably. And it certainly is the way Flocka eats. Yeah.
Do you consider dogs who are reactive barkers, is that part of an anxiety? Like if they you know, they hear a dirty PSA on and they're like, rah, 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 or,
I think that is anxiety. That's Aspen. She hears something and she barks.
Yeah.
The problem is with her, we think also some enjoyment takes over after a couple of barks. But the first barks are startle barks.
Yeah.
So the thing about noises, though, that's interesting, that's different from your thing, Kathleen, but it has something to do with yours, and is that so much of this has to do with orientation. So if they hear the ping of a microwave, it's so short they can't orient to it. And all animals, including us, want to orient to the sounds that we hear. So if you hear an airplane over, it's so frustrating, isn't it? Because you hear an airplane, you look up and it's no airplane there because the sound travels faster. And so the sound is, you know, the airplane's there and you're hearing the sound and it sounds like it's coming here. And it's very disconcerting because you're not seeing what you think you ought to be seeing. So The orientation is, I mean, if you can help your dog start to orient towards something, it's probably worthwhile. So say, for instance, you had a dog that was gonna was fearful of the ping of a microwave, then maybe you could even have it do lots of pings at a low level. Now, the problem is that getting us to practice this kind of stuff is really hard, and you have to do a ton of repetitions in order to make it worthwhile. So most of the time, we just live with it because it's easier just to live with than to go, oh my God, I did it again. You know, I coughed. I can't believe it. I did it again. So, I mean, with Flocka, maybe I could cough over and over and over and over again, and maybe she would start to get used to it. I don't know. But that her orientation is a really big deal. So if there's anything you could do, particularly with like Mochi with the sound of the fan, if you could, you know, have her on your lap and somebody turn the fan on, and you know, you can do some counter conditioning, give her some treats while that's going on, and then as soon as the fan goes off, you put her down. Yeah. So you actually start creating an association. It's a good association. So that's certainly a possibility.
I have Dakota reacts to like, you know, when it's really quiet at night and things settle and you'll just hear a pop or a crack or, like, I don't even know, like, metal making a noise. And he just, like, pops. And it's that, I never thought of it that way, but you have no idea where that's coming from. Like,
yeah.
I look around the room, like, I have no idea.
Well, just think of that. You might hear a shot, right?
Yeah.
Somebody shoots something, and you're like, where is it?
Yeah.
So we orient. We
yeah.
always orient towards the sound. And if you can't find the sound, that creates anxiety. That's part of the creation of anxiety, is you can't orient towards what it is. So if you can help.
The other thing is, I always tell people who, especially if they live in a really quiet neighborhood, and there's some sort of punctuated, unexpected noise, I always tell them if they're going to leave, they can leave some white noise on or leave the radio on, because that'll help them out.
Indeed, one of the things that's really good when you're leaving a radio on is to leave it near the area where a sound might come. So, for instance, if you live someplace where there are unexpected sounds out of one side of your house, having the white noise or the radio on over on that side of the house to help mask it. And I've had clients say, well, that's not fixing the behavior. No, it's not. But it's really hard to fix this behavior, and it might not be worth it to try. And in fact, in trying to fix this behavior, you might make it worse. Yeah?
Yeah, I've kind of observed over the years of shelter animals in the kennels, when they're really frightened, when they're always looking up to try and figure out where the noises are coming from. And even our dogs, anything from up above seems to be more sensitive to than the noise that's down.
Remember the dog I was talking about last week who went into the garage and suddenly started looking up? And I'm like, okay, you guys have rats, which insulted them, but, you know. But the fact is that that's what the dog was doing, is orienting towards the ceiling. Yeah.
What could one do to help with a phobia of the guards' keys
The what?
The guards make their rounds.
Oh, you mean like in the shelter when the guard walks around and wakes up, turns on the light and wakes up everybody?
No, we have a terribly fearful dog.
It's San Quentin?
Right now. And she goes off hysterically. The guards come to in the middle of the night. They make their rounds and they have these giant claws and keys.
Where is she? Is she with one of the guys?
Yeah. What can they possibly do to try and get
something? Well, there could be. Could you get a white noise machine or something?
I think so.
Could you convince the inmate to wake up before the guards start?
They don't know when they're coming.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing you can do is throw a party, but I'm sure he does not want to do that.
Oh, the poor guy, he's trying to get a little sleep.
Right.
Too.
So
there have been times when we've had that issue before at San Quentin, and we said this isn't a good dog for San Quentin.
Yeah.
But in many ways, it's being an ideal place for a dog. You can't send it back.
So how about? I mean, I've thought of this before, and I actually looked it up, and I think there might be some possibility of getting earplugs for the dog. The ones I remember looking at, they actually had a string that attached, and then the earplugs were like, would go into the dog's ears. And then they make for gun dogs, they make these enormous things.
Yeah, like, dogs, like,
yeah. But I mean, it seems like if you could do something to muffle the sound, that might be helpful.
The only problem is it might make, of course, like senior dogs tend to get more noise sensitive as they raise their motor because they start losing some of that range and stuff. So
it startles them even more.
Does the dog react during the day when they hear the keys?
Yes,
and it's not as bad during the day.
Because there's not the thing is that with sound, it's the amount of difference. It's the difference between the ambient noise, which is very low, and the startling noise, which is very high. So that differentiation means that the dog is going to get much, much more fearful, because instead of it being from here to here, it's from here to here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If the guards know where the dog is, could they muffle the sound of
that? No. At San Quentin? No. No. Are you kidding? They're like, why do you have dogs there?
Oh.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
Even though it's during the day, could you get something that sounds like these keys or a bunch of whatever random keys and then work on?
Sure.
Just like you're talking about Mochi. Like
yeah, you could do that. Get some keys.
So when it gets quiet at night,
yeah,
they could do that.
That a little bit.
The cellmate.
It something. Might help. I'm not sure that it would solve anything, but it might help.
It doesn't seem to bother her in the daytime.
So like at night, let's say they turn off all the lights and then they have the keys, the guards aren't coming around yet, and then you could just start with the lower noise, increase.
It rattled with the keys. And
then just increase it, would that work?
It would depend on whether the inmate wants to do that.
Yeah.
And then they somehow have to
say, you have to say it loud. This is a workshop, so you actually have to say it louder.
I mean, something that makes...
I'm just imagining where we're going to come up with this random set of keys and eyes and...
But they're going to let me
make
it.
You guys going to get out there? These are, you know, anybody who's at San Quentin is there for a reason. So... Yeah. They won't make the right noise, I don't think. Yeah. Yeah, I mean... Seems like if you could do some desensitization, that would probably be helpful. It may not make it okay, but it should be. And where does she sleep?
She sleeps in her crate.
She sleeps in her crate. Did they cover the crate?
Yeah, we told them to cover the crate.
Okay, I would try. And she's a little dog.
Yeah, she was the thing I've ever seen.
How about a jacket too?
Oh, I've
yeah. Something like that.
I don't know, because she does wear jackets a lot because she gets cold.
Well, she may not wear them at night.
We'll look into that. I'll
yeah. I mean, this is reaching because it is. I mean, it is San Quentin, so it's going to be really hard to, you know.
We do have thunder coats there, and we also have straight
jackets. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Doggy straight jacket.
Doggy straight jacket. Yeah, they could call it that. So, I think a lot of you, I already mentioned that the dog that was really fearful of the sound of the foghorns. They lived in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so we ended up, she would be okay as long as the dryer was going, because the dryer made a thunk, thunk, thunk noise. And so that was that kind of white noise. And so she was fine. But the problem is the woman had to get up every hour and a half to turn the dryer back on because it would go off. So she still wasn't getting any sleep.
It's like having an infant.
Yeah, every hour and a half. And I tried to convince her to move, and she said no, she didn't want to move. So, but we did come up with a solution. That's that dog there. I mean, you can't even see the dog underneath there, but there was a dog under there. And so she was destroying the house on a regular basis. So yeah, we did come up with a solution, which had to do with what we're just talking about now. We raised some ambient noise, then we added some soothing behaviors, like a massage. Whenever she recorded the sound of the fog, of the foghorns, then she would turn that on, give the dog a massage while that was going on, and it actually did help. Again, I don't think it fixed it entirely, but it made it livable, which is kind of where we go, right? We want to make sure things are livable, you know, as opposed to perfect. There we go. So genetics is a really strong reason for dogs to be temperamentally fearful, or to be fearful. And if you want to create a fearful dog, just breed two fearful dogs together, and guess what? You're going to get fearful puppies. It's the same thing with aggression. If you want to have an aggressive dog, then breed two aggressive dogs together, and you will get some puppies that are aggressive. And I think most of us who are in the dog field understand the strengths of genetics in raising of dogs or the living with dogs, but I think many, many owners do not think of that at all. They think that they are clay to be molded, and that just because you get a dog that had two aggressive parents doesn't mean that the puppies are likely to be like that. So you're almost always dealing with that. And in fact, I'd say an awful lot of the clients I see who have fearful dogs, I spend a lot of the time convincing them that it's not their fault. And I'll even convince them of that when I think it probably is their fault. Because it's no good for them to think it's their fault. I mean, unless the behavior that they're doing right now is causing it to happen. But as soon as they start changing their behavior, then guilt is not a good training tool. So we have to move forward. It's like Steve White always says, he says, you train like you're a GPS person, a GPS. If the dog is doing something wrong and you want to fix it, you don't worry about why they're doing it wrong. You just want to fix it. Now, I think you should worry about why they're doing it wrong too, but that's my curiosity. But you just go to fix it. You try to change it. And that's true with people too. You should really be helping them to gain enough confidence so that they can do what they're supposed to do. Unlike this woman who was told that, you know, she was just a terrible, the one who had the San Francisco trainer, that she was just really stupid and she couldn't do anything. Yes?
So I have my first behavior foster right now. It's a small, shut down, very shy chihuahua. And I guess I'm curious, because you have a lot of shelter experience along with you guys, is what my role is. I only have her for 5 days. I'm returning her Monday because my surgery is Tuesday. So I'm doing what I can. She's come out of her shell so much already, and we are making progress. But she is, I don't think she's ready yet. And she definitely can bond to people, but she's afraid of my husband and, you know, all the things. So the question is, when I bring her back, can I encourage a second foster? Can I? Okay. Because I'm afraid that it's, because I'm afraid I try to go too fast, and I know better, and I'm afraid that if she goes into adoptions, and there's people, and I'm just nervous.
Well, she's not going to make any progress if she's in the shelter.
Okay. So that's like a legit, like, she should go to another foster or whatever, and that's a good thing to promote. Okay.
5 days.
No, I do know that, and I'm being hard on myself too, because...
Well, and the other thing that's important here is that if she goes from foster to foster to foster, she won't get much better either.
So that was my next question.
Yeah.
Is at what... I just don't want to harm...
Well, that's why most people who foster fearful dogs end up adopting them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they knew that I only had 5 days, and at this point, Dawn was like, I just want to know if you think she's workable, right? Because then we have the type of foster that's a let's try to fix it foster, and we have the is it workable foster, which she knew with my short term that was involved in the field. So I was just curious. So that is something that is a good strategy. I can encourage the second foster.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I would think of...
She has so much potential.
Yeah, it you know, and when they go back and forth.
That's what I was really...
You know, if you think about shelter dogs that are adopted and then taken, returned, and then adopted and returned and adopted and returned, you know, we've noticed over the years that you know there are they're like used dogs, they no longer trust, they don't believe that anything is going to be permanent, and so they tend to be very unreliable. So they actually are building their own graves at the same time that we are doing it for them. So digging, not building. Yeah, anyway, yeah, I would do that.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
And it seems like each time they're brought back, it's harder on them. Like
it's worse. Yeah.
Yeah. There's less that they can handle to the point where it's just.
Yeah. So it gets worse, and at some point, it's like it's
really
better.
Bad.
It's better to let them go.
Yeah.
If they're, especially if a dog keeps on coming back, there is a reason. Even if people say, oh, yeah, well, I just don't have time, That's not, yeah.
They're better staying with one foster rather than circulating.
Yep, yep.
This organization that's sponsoring her, PAWFund, believes that they should rotate and go from foster to foster to be exposed to different circumstances and people. And I don't want to give her up until she goes to permanent home.
I think you're right. And I think the foster, I understand where that foster organization is coming from because they think we're building resiliency in, but I think you're more building the feeling that the world is an non-permanent place, and they need to establish a relationship.
And one of the greatest needs is look at homeless kids who end up going from foster home to foster home.
Yeah.
They start to trust, and then their trust is broken. And then they start to trust, and then they stop trusting. And what these homeless dogs need more than anything is consistency.
Yeah.
If they don't get any consistency, then they're just lost.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, yeah, if you could talk the foster group into doing that, but they probably won't, because they probably think, oh, no, this is how you do this, you know.
Right. Yeah. The thing is to keep them in the same home, but still expose them to new things.
Yes,
still
have a base.
The home,
you have a base, and then you go out from the base, but they have that base. They keep coming back to the base.
Person.
Yeah.
Except
yeah.
Or
you could pay, yeah, you could, you could. What you do is you put an ad in Craigslist. And then you have people come and visit your dog. You like that one, don't you? That's
just untrue.
What's that? It's hard to believe that a professional trainer would say, don't go do that. And the thing that amazes me about it also is that she's liable. Say this woman did that and followed the instructions and then she got murdered or something like that. The dog trainer is actually liable because that is advice that she gave the person. You know. So just blows me away. Okay, so there are breeds that are bred for fear and anxiety, and one of them is right now the German Shepherd. So this place I was at in the East Bay the other day with the big German Shepherd that's kind of scared me, I said, you know, the thing that we talk about, that these German Shepherds are pessimists, they're pretty sure that what's going to, could go wrong will go wrong, and they are sure that they're the ones who have to control it. So they spend their life being hypervigilant, and that's what this dog is doing, So this is something that over the years people have bred for, and it's possibly a certain part of it is inadvertent. So if you're breeding for a dog that's very vigilant, then in actual fact, you're probably breeding for a certain amount of fear, aren't you? So because vigilance, if a dog is not very vigilant, that means they're not very fearful. But if you want a dog that thinks that is a guard dog, you could be breeding for vigilance, and vigilance always has fear. The opposite is what a lot of the guide dog type breeders have been breeding for, which is the lack of vigilance. I mean, what would you call it? Just mellow, docile, easy, follow instructions really easily. And what they did is they bred for a lack of fear. They also got fallout, of course. They got this appetite that won't stop. And then they got more fear in a funny way. So they didn't have this kind of fear, so they got a different kind of fear. That spooky thing.
They breed for that, like, for the ability, being biddable or docile, their appetite increases?
Yes. It's fallout. Their appetite increase. Yeah. So, well, they're also breeding for oral stuff for a lot of them.
Yeah.
A lot of them are. But I know that guide dogs that was one of the reasons that they started using the Golden Lab mixes is because they also get no drive, of course. If you start breeding.
We get the no drive one.
Yeah, like a
dog
organization. Whatever. Yeah, so you wouldn't want one of that, something like that. You have, for a guide dog, you have to actually have a certain amount of motivation to lead. But for other kinds of assistance dogs, I don't know what you have to breed for a comfort peacock?
Yeah. Peacock.
Where is she?
I don't know, but the airlines cracked down.
Yeah.
You ruined it for everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I was going to do that. Well, there was somebody who brought in a snake. Comfort snake. Anyway, yeah. So the other things that are in that Temple Grandin points out, which I think actually does have some validity, is the heavier build the dog, the more likely they are to be less likely they are to be fearful. The lighter boned the animal is, and the less coat, the more likely they are to be fearful. So you get Chihuahuas who have very lightly built. Of course, they're very small. They're definitely, you know, prey. And compare Aspen to Flocka or to your little one here. She is much more assertive and whatnot. She's got a slightly bigger build, and she also has a lot of coat. So what Temple Grandin talks about are like the horses, the thoroughbred horses, which are really kind of spooky and nervous and flighty, compared to some of the bigger build horses like Clydesdales. Yeah, that are just, and so if you think in terms of what we think of as a really good golden retriever, they usually are fairly, you know, solid and heavy built and whatnot, and pretty phlegmatic. Like, you know, not that easily spooked.
So when you have a litter and you have, what do you call the smallest dog?
The runt?
So one of my clay dogs, she was the runt, and they knew from the beginning, they said, we saw a picture of her and she just looked scared, and she's definitely anxious. She was, like, sweet, like you would think of a retriever, golden retriever, and really, but anxious, like she wants to constantly jump up on you, and she's just anxious about stuff, but she's a slight dog.
Mm-hmm.
She's not a big, she's about 42 pounds. She's very lean, long legs. I wonder, so do runts generally have, do you think there's anything with that?
No, I don't. I mean, I think runts generally are smaller and lighter build. And they also might be picked on more when they're puppies. But I don't know of any other, that I don't think any kind of study has been done on that or anything. Not that I know of that it necessarily a study has been done on large breed, large bone dogs and small bone dogs either. But it is just kind of interesting. It's like the thing that Trisha and I noticed several years ago about all these dogs with their digestive issues that are fearful. And we started drawing these correlations. Okay, how is this dog's digestion? And it is amazing how often the two things go together, a fearful dog and poor digestion, or the inability to eat, or the inability to retain their food. You know, they throw up more often. So.
What about, like,
Mary? She's talking to Mary.
She knows.
Marion.
It's my pockets.
Shit. She knows who this. She says, I know who's got this.
I'm sorry, yeah.
There are so many things that there are correlations, but you often don't know which way the causation goes, or if there's a feedback.
That's right, yeah.
Causation goes back in the other one stuff.
Is that, like, if they burp a lot, like, is that part of...
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, burping is usually what's part of digestion, but if you burp too much, that means you're getting too much air in there. I mean, if you think about fearful dogs, they either can't eat, or they eat like they're eating popcorn at a scary movie. And that's what this healer did, is, like, I had to really watch it, or else she'd take my whole hand with her when she was eating a piece of carrot.
But also, with her, she's tiny. So you don't know how much of it might be structural, the way she's put together.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I was thinking about when you came and evaluated Buster, and you waited, and then eventually you were tossing some cheese to him,
mm-hmm.
and you were concerned because he was such a stressed out dog and so fierce, and then he was able to eat, and then you said, that totally worries me.
Yeah, it was, because he could eat even though he was in a state of high stress.
Yeah. And that's when you're talking about the ADR going.
Right, because he had got to the point where he actually was comfortable with being terrified.
Yeah.
You know, because that was his constant state.
Yeah.
And so he had actually made being in that state normal. And that always bothers us. Because if you, you know, if they have found that that's the way to solve their problem by barking and lunging at people, and they're now comfortable with that, then your chances of actually fixing the behavior problem or really, really getting some forward movement go down dramatically. Yeah. So, and of course, in the, as in the case of Buster, if they are dangerous during the time that you're working on them, that's when you kind of go, I don't think we can do this. Okay, so the speaking of this, the most difficult situations, the areas where the dog is already comfortable and something or someone novel is introduced, sudden environmental change is a really difficult position to find yourself in, or situations in which they already have a preconceived idea of what to expect. So the first one would be if I brought my dog to your house, I mean, if I went to your house to work with your dog and that the sudden environmental change, you've now added a person, or they've gone to a dog park and somebody has come in, or they've gone anywhere and somebody has come in. It's just a sudden environmental change. And that actually makes a lot of sense. And then, but, you know, and I'm always amazed at people who say, you know, he's wonderful until you take him to the vet. And then he's like, Cujo. And I go, did he have any bad experiences at the vet? Yeah, but that was a long time ago. Well, their single event learning is, you know, it exists. And the dog learned at the vet hospital, and it doesn't even matter which vet hospital in a lot of cases, because apparently they all smell the same. And the dog is going to have a poor response to that. The interesting thing about veterinary house visits is that some dogs do much better if their owner is present, and some dogs do much better if they're not present. And you have to be able to figure out your own dog. When I had Rottweilers, Joe-Bear and Barney, they were much, much better if I was in the room with them. Then they were fine. As soon as I left the room, they were not fine. And they terrified the vets. Can't imagine why. I still think being a veterinarian is probably one of the scariest things in the world. And I couldn't understand why they have a high rate of alcoholism and suicide. Yeah. But vet hospitals, sometimes certain walks, certain environments will cause a dog to actually have problems. And you can start to predict that. So I'm trying to think. I guess that of the two, you know, I'd almost prefer the sudden. Well, no, I guess I'd prefer having the knowing what's going to cause my dog to get upset as opposed to being surprised by it. You know, so we're all sitting here and all of a sudden Aspen starts to bark like crazy and we didn't even know what the sudden environmental change was.
So is that where single event learning comes in as well?
Sudden change, or is it usually, but not necessarily. A single event learning could be an attack by another dog. Yeah. It normally does encompass some surprise, you know, because they weren't expecting it to happen. So in that case, yeah, it would be sudden environmental change. But it's also there's you know, they learned through that event that awful things are going to happen. And if you say you go to a vet and the vet is really too rough on the dogs, that can qualify as single event learning. There's no single. There might not be an SEC there. It just might be that I don't trust people who wear white jackets and stick their fingers up my butt, you know, or whatever. So, okay, so. What I want to do now is let's take a break, and then when we come back, we'll do our consult, okay?